It is an apocalyptic vision of all monsters destroying the Earth with a star-studded cast and some of the biggest special effects in the series. But can the Avengers-like sequel by director Michael Daugherty work with kaiju? Buckle up aboard the USS Argo with us and deploy your oxygen destroyers, because the legendary Monsterverse shows up this week and puts some major points on the scoreboard for American-made Godzilla films. This is Kaiju vs. History, Godzilla, King of the Monsters.
Kaiju versus History. This is a monarch soldier somehow surviving several encounters with Ghidorah, Miles, and joining me is a molten slag burning Big G reducing Boston to ashes, Patrick. Patrick, how are you doing this week?
Austin really gets it. Really gets it bad in that movie. Oh boy.
Not bad enough. I think it could have gotten worse. Boston's been on its high horse for far too long.
The final shot of the movie is like 10 kaiju standing in.
Oh, yeah.
Not like a single building still.
The entire time I'm watching that part, I'm like, yeah, Patrick's dead. I guess I'm doing the podcast by myself.
For sure. Well, I feel like, yeah, I would have pieced out of town. It's like, oh, yeah, by the way.
Oh, yeah. They did evacuate a lot of the town for sure.
Ghidorah just landed.
You might have been staying at my house.
Yeah, no one knew kaiju attacks in the South. I guess Florida gets it in the next Monsterverse movie.
But yeah, the South doesn't have. We need some kaiju action.
Well,
make it really Southern fried. I want like the gray man to like warn people that something's going to happen. That is a cut left. Unless you are aware of like coastal South Carolina ghost stories and famous lore, that's going to just soar over your heads. But.
Miles, it's worth nothing anyway, so just cash out your 401k and make this kaiju movie yourself.
What America do you live in? What 401k?
Okay, good point. It feels like we've been building up to this movie for years now, and I think part of that is because in the history of kaiju cinema and what we've been doing this podcast for, we've had, you know, outside of Showa and Heisei eras, I feel like we've had three big golden ages or booms of kaiju films. And obviously the 1960s is one of them. You can say that the original 1954 Godzilla spurned that, but it really took off in the 60s, where you're having like 3 to 5 kaiju movies come out of Japan every single year, which was nuts. And the next one,
when you talk about eras, you have to really take into consideration. Obviously, yes, everyone knows the 54 Godzilla is the one, but the era that it inspires is the 60s for sure. Oh, yeah. I'm right there with you, bud.
And then I would say 30 years later, the 1990s is the next one, where you have the, I would say, height of tokusatsu special effects, non-CGI special effects, and some of the best kaiju movies ever made between Godzilla and Gamera.
And Tremors.
My favorite decade. Yeah. Tremors, of course. Got to put one American on the board.
We're always going to have Tremors. I don't care.
And then I feel like the 2010s, but really the end of the 2010s and into the 2020s, where we're at kind of right now.
Mid 2010s. So, I mean, it's starting in between our decade. Yeah.
Yes, very much so. Starting with the 2014 legendary Godzilla, Shin Godzilla, and of course Pacific Rim. Feel like that reignited the passion for the genre in kind of the global market, not just Japan, not just the US, but everywhere. And that we're benefiting from that still now, in the fact that last year and the year before, two of like the biggest Godzilla movies to ever released, you know, one of the ones that did the best in Japan, one of the better performing ones in the US.
I mean, I mentioned last week that I think it's also been a perfect storm with the internet age in full front. You have you know, online file sharing coming to full front in the early 2000s, and then streaming services. And so being able to have all this access, and people are making wikis and websites dedicated to these things, and people are kind of making communities that they didn't even know existed out unless you were like, you know, a really cool nerd in the 90s and like IFC chats and stuff. Like, you really didn't have access or knowledge shared that we do now for the genre as a whole. Like, everyone knows Godzilla. Everyone kind of grew up with them, at least popping up on your Saturday afternoon film or on the Sci-Fi Channel or popping up in an MST3K episode. Like, we as Americans, we know Godzilla, but there's to find out there's more out there. And this is when, like, even in 2004, you get the first actual Western release of Gojira. Like, that's, I think it can't be understated, like, that we've been building up to this. And I think with, you know, what started with, like I said last week, with Cloverfield, but what really starts off, like you said, with Godzilla and Pacific Rim, where it's, I think, the powder keg explodes. This is where the perfect storm kind of comes together, and that we're still reaping the benefits from today. Mm-hmm. And I think the high point, like I mentioned this, like, I think when we first started this podcast, because I know a lot of film fans and, you know, that dabble in kaiju, who often have very wrong kaiju opinions anyway. I had someone tell me that Invasion of Astro Monsters was kind of boring, and I just told them to stop talking to me.
Communication.
They're a good friend of mine, but I was like, we're ending this conversation right now. But yes, I think everything kind of comes to the head here, and this is, I think, the litmus test. Like, if this movie, like, no matter how anyone feels about it, and I frankly don't care how anyone else feels about it, I've been very vocal about my feelings about this movie, but it showcases what people really wanted. And they had kind of indicated that when Godzilla and Skull Island came out. But here is like, okay, do people want this? And the answer was a resounding yes.
Yeah.
But yeah, I agree. I think we are currently in the midst, or maybe coming towards the end of, not the end of a golden age, but certainly the boom.
I think 2019 is kind of right there in the middle, or kind of the apex, because this coming out is like pretty major. But you know what else happened in 2019, Miles? The 15 film Showa Godzilla Criterion Collection released, which,
oh, you know, I know it.
For some of those,
I got that sitting on my shelf.
For some of those, a pretty major Blu-ray release that did not have access to in the original kind of Japanese format. But yeah, it did feel like 2019 is a pretty singular year in this new kind of renaissance of both good and bad kaiju films. And it's part of the reason this film is why I was like, wow, maybe they're not going to just drop this, because sometimes Hollywood just kind of drops films. Looking at you, Dark Monsterverse, drops them, like, if they're not performing well, they're like, we're not gonna make any more of these.
The
Mummy,
Dark Universe, which has been resurrected as an IP for the Universal Park.
Yeah, which is pretty funny. But yeah, when this movie came out, it's like, wow, this finally, people are kind of starting to realize how cool kaiju are. And part of that was me. Do you remember your theater going experience for this film, Miles?
Vividly.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw this movie 3, if not 4 times in the theaters.
Whoa. I would imagine you could remember that pretty well.
Yeah. So I saw this by myself for the first time, and I was so wowed by it, because my fiance was like, oh yeah, I want to see it. But I mean, she knew how excited I was for it. She's like, go ahead and like, if it's really good, like, you know, I want to see it. And I was just like, oh yeah, we're going immediately, like the next day.
Yeah, this is happening.
And then I think there was a time where, like, there was like nothing to do or something. I can't remember what it was. We had time to kill, and I was like, oh, you want to see Godzilla again? And she was like, yeah, I'm marrying the right woman. But yeah, I remember being in the theater. It was one of those great, it was a matinee, and it was like a Thursday or something, like I cut off work early or something. And the great thing about some of those early screenings is, unlike how they were back in the day, where like you'd have one Thursday showing, if a movie comes out on a Friday, it comes out on a Thursday. Mm-hmm. That's just how it is now. And I remember going to that showing. There was no one at that one. I sat directly in the middle of the theater. It was the perfect temperature. It was the perfect, like, it was like, they,
it was perfect.
For whatever reason, my theater doesn't always turn the lights out sometimes. They're like sometimes a little dim, and that just incenses me.
Oh, no. No, thank you.
Yeah, they were completely out, and I just had the absolute best theatrical experience. Like, it was just perfect. And I just remember being wowed. I felt like a kid again watching that. And largely, there's many, many reasons that we're going to talk about that. Did you have a theatrical experience with this one?
Yeah. And you know what's funny is I think in 2018, I started using Atom tickets for my movie going. So I have like a record of like what I see in the theaters, but it doesn't say like what day. If I saw it on the Friday or the Saturday, I'm pretty sure I saw it the opening weekend because I was so angry that I wasn't able to get out to the 2014 Godzilla in theaters because I think I told a story. My wife watched it with as like a school trip with
team. Oh yeah, and you couldn't go or something.
Oh yeah, nonsense. I was like, yeah. Oh, do you want to see it again or can I come? And she was like, no, you can't. I was like, okay. And I just didn't get a chance to. And then I was very unhappy. The both of us did not see Kong Skull Island in theaters when we were together that weekend.
Yeah, that is certainly a regret. Like, I mean, we had a great week, so I'm not regretting anything we did. But at the same time,
took 3 hours out of that weekend to go see that together.
Yeah, I do regret not seeing that in the theaters because I know you and I had talked about it, and our friends were kind of because it was a large group, the largest we've had in terms of all of us being together, and I think you and I were the only ones.
Oh yeah, that's the thing. No one else
was excited about that.
But I feel like even our kaiju or our friends who are not into kaiju as much as we are would have enjoyed that theatrical experience.
I fully agree.
This is a movie, and you know they say movie theaters are dying, but I feel like this is the movie that you go see on the big screen. And I do remember, I'm pretty sure it was like a pretty packed theater. So I saw it sometime on that first weekend, I want to say. It was great. There was, you know, and I've been to several kaiju movies in theater since then because you are there usually in the opening weekend with people that all are big fans and are excited about what they're going to see. I will say the most recent one of Godzilla X Kong New Empire, boy howdy was that crowd excited. You know, opening night, or I think I saw that on the Thursday, like you're mentioning. So those people are like super dedicated to seeing the movie. But yeah, I had a great experience with this in theaters, and it is one of those movies. And normally it's something that really bugs me, but when audiences clap once the credits roll, I'm just like, come on, there. No one that made the movie was here, but it was like kind of a cathartic experience. You know, they're seeing something on the screen that just supercharged them up, and I kind of got behind it there. So yeah, big fan of seeing this one in the theaters. And honestly, whenever a new Godzilla movie comes out, they should just re-release this in theaters because I feel like it would do okay, you know. I feel like people would want to do also the marathon kind of experience. I feel like this would do well with some of the newer Godzilla versus Kong films. Maybe not Godzilla 2014, but I feel like this one would do very well. Are you ready to start talking about the history, what went into making Godzilla King of the Monsters, Miles?
Yes, because I think you kind of had questioned me last week, but they along with this plan in October 2015, Legendary confirmed that they would bring both Kong and Godzilla together as part of a shared universe plan. At the time, they wanted Gareth Edwards to do an entire trilogy of Godzilla films, which obviously didn't happen, but the plans to share a cinematic universe centered around Monarch has come into fruition, thankfully. And
yeah, I was thinking the next movie was, I feel like the contract was terminating at some point between Toho and Legendary.
It was supposed to be terminated with Godzilla versus Kong.
Oh, right, right, right. But that one did so well. Yes, that you're
yes,
correct.
Yes.
That they were just like, yeah, whatever. Just keep making movies. We'll do our own. But yeah. Who cares?
They looked at their bank account. You're like, you know what, guys? You know, you Americans finally figured it out. So we're just going to let you play in our sandbox for a little bit. We're going to go over here and make one of the best kaiju movies ever made. And, you know, don't mind us.
Well, supposedly there's a little bit of ill will between Legendary and Toho because of, I think...
Oh, Toho doesn't like to play nice? Shocker.
Well, I think it's back-end points on, like, merchandise sales, which, boy howdy, you know, there's no world where Hollywood does not want to make 5,000 different toys of something like Godzilla vs. Kong.
They made 5,000.
There's tons. There's so
did many. Not even plan this, but, like, literally right next to me is a Godzilla King of the Monsters little set.
Oh, cool. Look at that.
Yeah, I mean, they're not the greatest toys, but, like, made so many Godzilla versus Kong or Godzilla King of the Monsters toys because, lo and behold, you got more monsters.
Yeah. Well, that's...
Let's not really make this one because we get some of our classic monsters returning to the screen for the first time in quite some time.
Miles, do you want to talk about the title first?
Yeah, I'm so sorry. I'm so excited to talk about this freaking movie. Patrick, tell me, what's in a title?
To be honest, I have rewatched this on DVD or on streaming services because it's been pretty consistently on either Netflix or now it's on Max, I believe.
Yeah.
I've watched this a few times since 2019, and I don't think I ever noticed there are no title credits for this movie. The title comes at the end of the film, and it does say Godzilla 2, King of the Monsters in the title at the end of the film.
I don't remember if the 2 was there in theaters, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, I was so confused when I saw it this time around, and I noticed, I was like, Godzilla 2? Is that what this was called?
It ain't on this box. It ain't on my Blu-ray. No.
I don't feel like it was on any poster.
It's an international title for this movie because I've seen the title card elsewhere. And so I wonder if when it got to streaming, if you know, Warner Brothers Discovery or was it just Warner Brothers AT&T at the time slapped that on there.
If this is Godzilla 2, is Godzilla X or V Kong, Godzilla versus Kong, is that Godzilla 3? You know?
Yeah, well, it's also Kong 2, so let's not like...
Yeah, you know, it's Kong, getting a little...
Kong 3, whatever.
Getting a little confusing in here, but it does feel like it is later in the series, which I'll talk about. But it is funny that it got that in several. The international title being Godzilla 2, King of the Monsters, Rey de los Monsters in Spain. Sometimes that two is Roman numerals. I think the English is very much a Arabic two. That was the working title or the early title was Godzilla 2. I don't think they had named it King of the Monsters at that point.
Sure.
King of the Behemoths in the Hong Kong translation of the film. And, I think we talked about this with the 2014 movie. Godzilla is just so ubiquitous. There's not really any other title variations for this movie.
Yeah, and you're also using like the classic subtitle for like the English speaking language version was Godzilla King of the Monsters. So like how could you not? I love that its working title was Fathom because in my head I'm like, that means Michael Turner's creation was involved in this as well. There's a comic book deep cut for folks who read Top Cow in the 90s.
But yeah, the Japanese title Jira Kingu Obu Monsatsu is where we get King of the Monsters, and that is kind of a throwback, like you said, to the American 1956 translated title. It makes it a little confusing. I do think I like it without the two behind the Godzilla.
I like it as just Godzilla King of the Monsters.
And yeah, like I said, I was surprised because I don't feel like I ever saw a poster or anything with the two. It's just that title card, and like I said, you can find that in a few different places listed. But it probably would have helped if they had continued making like single Godzilla movies to be like, this is Godzilla 3 or 4 or whatever. But at the time, you know, Avengers had just come out, was just about to come out, and all of the Marvel Cinematic Universe sequels were just Iron Man 2. I guess Thor, did Thor have numbers? No, I guess it didn't.
No.
But it was Iron Man.
Not here, it didn't.
Iron Man, Iron Man 2, and Iron Man 3, right?
Yes. Though yeah. I think Iron Man and, I mean, to some degree, Guardians of the Galaxy, they have the Volume 2, Volume 3.
Yeah.
I think those are the only ones that have numbers.
Everyone else subtitles. So they're kind of like so. Covering their bases by having Godzilla do King of the Monsters at the end there. But yeah, I was shocked, honestly, because I feel like I've seen this movie like 5 or 6 times, and maybe I had my eyes closed during that final credit sequence. But yeah, let's talk about.
Well, you're also like, you know, being gobsmacked by this amazing cover of Leuchter's Colt's Godzilla by Serge Tanaka of System of Down and Death Clock. Like, come
on. Boy, howdy. And I feel like we could talk about this first. The music in this movie is just amazing.
Chef's kiss all around.
I wanted from Godzilla 2014, which is a mix of, you know, very exciting kind of original soundtrack, you know, adding to the universe, updating some of the Akira Ifukube classics. And, you know, when those needle drops happen in the movie, it is licensed to throw all your popcorn and get crazy.
The needle drop, especially like, so the score itself was done by Bear McCreary, who understood the assignment to better than anyone has understood an assignment in kaiju cinema. If I'm being frank,
we just got a taste of his soundtrack in, he did 2016's Colossal. And I think this is before he did some more of his popular kind of TV show stuff. So I don't think I really knew.
Is it before Outlander?
Well, did he do?
He did all seasons of Outlander. That started in 2014.
Yeah, I guess I was thinking. I guess he did work on Walking Dead before.
Yeah, this, but and he I did guess Agents I just Shield didn't, too.
I didn't really know of his work, but I feel like after this, I was like, who did the soundtrack for this movie?
he also worked like with, like, you know, obviously Metalocalypse, and so obviously bringing his famous friends along for the ride, because the needle drops in this thing are delicious, especially when you get the original Godzilla. You get two specific needle drops of the original Godzilla theme, and both of them are beyond epic.
Yeah, pretty much. There's little callbacks to a lot of Akira Ifukube's scores and other scores like Rodan's music and things like that.
Mm-hmm. King Ghidorah.
Yeah, and boy howdy, it is one of the best kaiju soundtracks, I feel, since the original, since some of the 1960s. So,
because it's very a good soundtrack that also has kind of a best of, and you get to hear these themes done at their most bombastic in full high definition, in high fidelity. It's amazing work. And I think it's both because Bram McCreary does an amazing job, but also because the filmmakers utilize all of these themes. And every monster kind of gets their moment in the sun with their song. And it's incredible in that way. But let's kind of like go back to, you know, you were wanting to build up the history of this one. You know, this movie does have some dedications to Haru Nakajima and Godzilla vs. Hedorah director Yoshimitsu Bano, both of whom passed away in 2017.
Yeah, and Bono, we talked about, was pretty much instrumental in developing the rights that would eventually be sold to Legendary for a CGI Godzilla film, basically. A more special effects-driven production. And originally, we talked about this in the 2014 episode, Godzilla episode. It was for like a theme park kind of experience. And those rights he was able to bring to Legendary or a few different American companies. But that's how we got the 2014 Godzilla movie, which we have rated excellent. You know, it's a great movie. Mm-hmm. Not our favorite Godzilla movie, but at the time, definitely our favorite American Godzilla movie. Not that there's a lot of competition, but
It is now.
Very, very good film. And this one was able to exist and thrive because that one did very well in theaters, did very, very good business, mm-hmm. and helped out both Legendary and Toho. But yeah, I mean, gosh, there's so much to talk about with this movie. I think, as you mentioned, originally, I think Gareth Edwards was going to continue on with sequels. And because this got pushed back a couple of times, I think he had to step away from the project. And
yes.
Is it Michael Dougherty? I think maybe I mispronounced his name earlier, came in and took over for it. He has a lot of writing credits, and I think this is probably his biggest directorial debut. He directed a bit of the Trick or Treat film, which...
No, he directed Trick or Treat.
Isn't that like multiple directors, I thought?
Nope, written and directed by...
I thought it was because
like people are still segments. People are, no, it is an anthology, but he wrote and directed all of it.
Oh, that's
it's not one of those situations. And people have been begging for a new one for now almost 20 years.
He did the 2015 Krampus mm-hmm. direction as
it's
well.
It's a very fun movie.
Yeah. And yes, he worked a bit on some of the Godzilla versus Kong films story wise, but passed the reins to Adam Wingard for this last
mm-hmm.
last couple of films. But yeah, he does a great job here, and you know, stepping in, taking over this project and making it really come alive. And I think perhaps more than almost any other kaiju film, at least in the modern era, is really infused with a love and a pretty good amount of respect for both Showa and Heisei era Godzilla films. We get a lot of references and obviously a lot of kaiju from some of those Showa era films. And in general, just the action, I think you've mentioned a few times, this is like, what if the creatives of the Showa era had mm-hmm. the technology and the budget to produce a film of a similar kind of quality?
Yeah, I mean, I've said since I saw this movie is like, yeah, this is a $200 million, or how much did it cost? $170 to $200 million film. So $200 million Showa era film. Like, mm-hmm. there are, I mean, some people who just don't really love every Godzilla movie that you know, you and I kind of do, that often will complain about the human element, certainly in the American movies, and that's no different here. They're like, oh, why is, you know, 11 from Stranger Things crawling around this thing and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, you fools, absolute peons. Like, this is straight up a Showa era plot that was given a ton of money. And I mean, honestly, a star-studded cast. You've got Kyle Chandler and Vera Farmiga, both of whom are kind of, you know, they're sort of really main characters. There's several of them. You got Millie Bobby Brown, who this is kind of before, and kind of a reminder that, hey, once upon a time, she was an actress and not a Netflix studio player, mm-hmm. Which I know sounds backhanded, and it kind of is, but because she is a very good actress, and like getting to see her actually act here, as opposed to, like, you know, I haven't watched a ton of her non-Stranger Things stuff, like Anoa Holmes or Damsel. A lot of them just don't look like they're very great, but you know, there was a time where like she did stuff outside of Netflix, and I really like her performance here.
She had filmed season one of Stranger Things, and maybe had just come out, but I want to say she filmed this between season one and seasons two. Like, I don't think she had like super blown up, but by the time the movie had come out, season two of Stranger Things.
No. Season two, I think, had already come out.
Well, I'm saying, I think when they filmed this, I think, because she looks pretty darn young here. I don't know.
So this came out in
2019.
This came out when season three came out.
Oh, okay. So at that point, yeah, then she definitely was a household name. I remember a lot of people were like, wow, it's crazy that they got Millie Bobby Brown.
Oh, but it's,
yeah, she, like you said, she wasn't like the mega star. Probably when they cast her in this, you know,
right. But it doesn't stop with her. You got Bradley Whitford, who I think is kind of like the understated MVP of this movie for me.
He's got some great lines.
He's so good. I love Bradley Whitford. And they cast him perfectly in this movie. The absolute right character. But Sally Hawkins, Charles Dance as kind of our villain here, as far as the humans are concerned. Yeah, he's our villain here.
Also someone from television who's on fire in 2019. He plays, of course, a pretty despicable villain. Like, he's much more likable here, which is kind of funny. But he plays a Lannister in the Game of Thrones series. And
yeah.
Oh, he has the line. Oh, gosh. Does he say long live the king?
Yes, he does. I think
he has some king line. It's like, oh, he said no. Said something.
No, he says something about the king. But I think I want to say Bradley Whitford says something about the king.
Oh, at one point as well. Farmiga also, I feel like, says that at some point. There's a lot of silly line drops like that. But
you got Thomas Middleditch, Aisha Hines, O'Shea Jackson Jr., who does a really fantastic job here, drops our PG-13 F-bomb in perfection in reference to Ghidorah. David, is it Strathairn?
Yes, a great character actor who he was in the 2014 Godzilla movie. I feel like it was a pretty small role as well. His role is pretty small in this movie and feels like maybe there were some reshoots in some of it, because he's just like on a screen for the last part of his kind of performance. And of course Ken Watanabe, and I think they already mentioned Sally Hawkins is back from the first film.
I love that they gave Ken Watanabe more of a role, and getting to play this kind of version of Dr. Sarazawa, which I really, really love. And we also get kind of an appearance by Zhang Ziyi, who is basically, I think, supposed to be like, so she plays the mythologist Dr. Eileen Chen, but I think she also plays the twins.
Yes, they
in the photos. That is a reference to obviously our little beauties.
Well, so she's like a main Monarch. I think both her and her sister are Monarch members. Eileen is the only one that speaks, because she's like the main character on the bridge of the USS Argo, and is the one giving us, like, you know, the natives or the ancient peoples called this one Rodan. And she's the one naming these monsters.
Yes.
We see in a photograph, and for some reason, her mom and her grandmom are also twins. It's like, oh boy, that's not right. That shouldn't be. It gives it the mythical element, and
it's a clear, like, because even Gareth Edwards was like, I always wanted to have the Shobuj in there, to have a little bit of that mystical element, but like not fully leaning into it. Just that reference to Mothra, you know.
I feel like the picture would have been enough, but we do get the twin, Dr. Ling Chen, she's at Mothra's emergence from the cocoon. So she's in China for, I guess, all the film that we see her. Not that it's like losing points for this alone, but there's just like several things in this movie that feel like we're left on the cutting room floor. And one of them is a split screen of the two sisters coming together, perhaps. Maybe when Mothra shows up at the submarine, kind of towards the end of the film. I feel like that would have been a good time, but yeah, it is a lot to cram into this film, but a representation of the twin fairies is great.
Yeah.
We don't really get that in Godzilla X Kong, the New Empire, but there is, you know,
but they do dig into the mysticism of Mothra. So I was pretty happy with that,
which is surprising because that wasn't supposed to be Mothra. It's supposed to be like a brand new kaiju. And they're like, nah, you got to bring back Mothra.
Yeah. Everyone loves Mothra.
Yeah. The entire cast is stacked top to bottom. And I mean, there are too many characters. You know, there's so much going on in this movie that
This movie does such a great job of orchestrating everything. Like they do for a movie that is 2 hours and 20 minutes thereabouts. No, just 2 hours and 12.
Yeah.
It orchestrates everything pretty well. And it does a thing that we'll see multiple times in this franchise, where you have characters whose kind of pathos begins in San Francisco in 2014, because we're going to revisit that Monarch in full force. And I like that we have, that's where we start with our first main characters, and then get this kind of fun tease that, like, oh no, they're not in some suburban home. They are in a Monarch outpost in, like, is it South America that they're at?
China.
Oh, they're in China. Sorry.
So, yeah, instead of there being an infant island, they tie Mothra more directly to mainland China, which, you know, for marketing and kind of mythology reasons, I enjoy a good deal, because...
And having Zang Ziyi as representing the Shobujin is an excellent choice.
Yeah. Having every kaiju come from some island somewhere is not not a good idea. Because is Rodan on an island as well?
Rodan is in the volcano in, is it Rio de Janeiro?
No, I think it's supposed to be Mexico.
Yeah, it is. No, it's, well, I thought it was South America. Mm-hmm. Is where they were. I could be wrong, because where is that big cross?
Well, that shows up, that is in Rio, but that's in Godzilla X Kong, the New Empire.
No. Where King Ghidorah does his little, like...
Oh, cross, yes. No, yeah, the Jesus is what I'm thinking of.
That's right. The Rio de Janeiro is the Redeemer, yeah. So this cross is in Mexico. I think you're right.
It is Isla de Mara, Mexico, which...
That's right.
Is it Rio? I forget. I didn't look this one up, but... No, it is a fictional island. So I think to set Rodan apart from Mothra a little bit, they decide to have only one of them on an island. But yes, Isla de Mara is a fictional place, and it's interesting. I don't understand quite putting Rodan in Mexico, but...
Oh, I do.
Well, at the end of the movie, they say that Rodan has flown to Japan. Or, like, one of the headlines at the end of the movie is, like, they've gone to a mountain in the kind of Japanese north. So they give up on Mexico, or Rodan gives up on Mexico pretty quickly.
I like that, because, I mean, you have a lot of, like, deities or important mythological or cosmological beings in the Mesoamerican cultures, like the Quetzalcoatl and stuff. So, like... placing that there and placing that the volcano outpost there, I thought was very, very cool. And it worked for me. I love how we get this. Like, you know, we find out that there is a monster that is so, like, secret that most elements of even Monarch aren't aware of it, which is, and I love this, Monster Zero, which is a great, I love all these callbacks to the actual origins. And it also kind of calls back to, and what this film does very well is, you know, we're always told that, well, Ghidorah is evil. Like, that's what we're always told, that, like, he's not just like this, that, or the other. He doesn't have this purpose. Like, he is just evil. And that was the one thing I kind of appreciated. One of the few things I appreciated about the anime Netflix is kind of delving into that. And this, while it doesn't explore it fully, it certainly utilizes it. Mm-hmm. And we get enough context to, like, okay, yes, this was not something of Earth. And this is something that is going to cause total destruction if it gets its way. And I really like that.
Plot-wise, it is so cool. Design-wise, I mean, this is, bar none, I think, my favorite Ghidorah across all media.
Oh, yeah, I'm with you, buddy.
And it's one of the reasons I just, in the show in Heisei Area, I just wasn't a huge fan of the monster, both from design, but also character points of view. This is the most character I think King Ghidorah has ever been. Not only is it a monstrous character itself, I love that the heads are so snake-like, so serpentine. They're like, at multiple points, they, like, kind of have
slither around. You know.
Yeah, they're not detached from the body, but they, like, move separately from the body and from one another, and, like, snake around buildings.
They do seem to all have personalities too, which is very cool.
Yeah, their own personalities. There's
no clear head, Kevin, but, you know.
No, the left head is depicted as Kevin in memes, a derpily kind of drawn version.
But, like, in the movie, it's not like it's, oh, and here's the idiot head.
Well, it's more inquisitive and is scolded by the other two heads, or particularly the middle head, a great deal. Like the first time we see Ghidorah, Kevin, the left head, is like investigating the monarch soldiers, but like not killing them. It's just like looking at them like very interestingly. And there's multiple times where it's like ears get snapped at and it's kind of like set straight. I just love it. The there were three different mocap actors that were tied together with a belt to bring Ghidorah to life. And, you know, how much of their performance was actually brought through or just kind of used by the animators, you know, we'll never know. But Jason Lyles, Alan Maxon, and Richard Dorton were the middle right and left head. And the middle head, Jason Lyles, also did mocap for Rodan in this movie. Did a great job. One thing we didn't mention in the last movie, because he was technically uncredited, was TJ Storm, a martial artist and mocap actor, was Godzilla's actor in the film. And yeah, in this universe where mocap can give so much of the kind of character for these monsters, I do want to kind of point that out. They did a great job. And I have the SH Figure Arts legendary Ghidorah on my shelf. It is absolutely the biggest toy, maybe the biggest toy I've ever owned in my life. It is huge. It is unwieldy. It is hard to hold. And it is great. It has so many points of articulation. And my wife surprised me with it, I think, for Christmas a few years ago. I was like, how did you know to get this one? This is like absolutely my favorite Ghidorah. I was stoked when I saw it, but then I was very unhappy because I was like,
it's a great one.
I have nowhere to put this. It's so big.
<It's> so they cute. Are pretty large.
Well, yeah, this one's just crazy. So many cool things they also do with Ghidorah in this movie, you know, from like all the posters. Sometimes the posters really do lie, but everything that is shown in the posters like happens in the movie, like the showdown in Boston with Godzilla, where they're both going at each other. Ghidorah's heads like arcing lightning into the sky is in the movie. Like they hold nothing back in that respect. The same thing, Godzilla, you know, blasting his atomic breath into the sky is in the movie. It's not just a poster, which is exciting. Is a
yeah.
moment that happens. Do you have a favorite kaiju update in this movie? We also get the design for Godzilla has changed a little bit in this film.
Gosh, I love Godzilla, and it kind of goes into what they would do making him more, I don't know, like it's something that kind of gets revisited, especially in the most recent film. They make him more kind of like cat or puppy like in like that when he sleeps and stuff. Mm-hmm. And you know, they round out his snout, so like especially you see him up close, he's kind of cuter in some aspects. But they also give him more personality. Like they give him more facial expressions. They give him more character. And I think that's one thing I really appreciate the most about it. I also really love, because it's the character I think that's gotten the least amount of love out of all of the monsters in its history. Rodan was nice to see, and nice to see yeah. that like got some really cool, like they leaned all into the Firebird aspect of it. And I really loved what they did with Rodan. I mean, honestly, it's all the monsters, because even Mothra got a little bit of an offensive upgrade. You got those little sharp legs that she was able to do some like actual offensive actions with, you know.
Design wise, this is like my least favorite Mothra.
Oh, I
like,
no, I love her.
I like her. Fluffy Mothras so much. And I think the Heisei is really just like my favorite. But I also just
I like that Mothra gets to throw some punches in this one.
Well, I just like that size-wise, it is so small. And I understand it's kind of like a underdog kind of moment when she's able to beat off Rodan. Yeah, that's a good point. It is technically baby Mothra. And I think they do size it up a little bit for...
Yeah, I think they do, too.
Godzilla, X-Kong, the new Empire. But yeah.
Yeah, love them all. All the monsters. I love the... I want more of that big old Mastodon.
Right. And so that's the other thing that they paid for. Legendary paid for four Toho monsters to appear in this film. And Michael Dougherty was pushing for more. He skirted by having Anguirus's bones in the underwater kind of temple in the film, but I don't think they paid for that. I think it was just like a blink and
look what this looks like, yeah,
kind of thing.
Yeah,
but yeah, they wanted to have like almost every Toho monster in this film. I think just like rights wise it was a little difficult, so they did the next best thing, I think, which is make up kind of new monsters. So a lot of them are kind of blink and you miss them, but named monsters, there is like 20 kaiju that are named in the film. We do get Methuselah, which I believe is the tusked monster. Oh no, Behemoth is the tusked monster. Methuselah is the mountain one. I think that comes out of Germany. Scylla will make a comeback in Godzilla X Kong, is kind of like a creepy spider with like tendrils, mouth tendrils. We get a Muto in this film as well. So it's like that species isn't gone. Like there's more of them, which is interesting. And what else? Oh, of course, like a ton of other ones are kind of shown, and maybe their destruction is shown a little bit, but yeah, they're named all over the map. There's a Quetzalcoatl, there's a Tiamat, which we will see in Godzilla X Kong. The one I was most excited about was one of the Japanese area monsters. There's a Yamato no Orochi listed in the in the Titans there. So yeah, tons of them, and supposedly they all are destroying Earth in this movie. We unfortunately get to see maybe 30 seconds of that destruction.
Yes.
So we get to see Behemoth, yes. I think, takes on Vegas. But yeah, that's a big miss for me. Is like, I cannot believe they didn't show a kaiju destroying the Arc de Triomphe or something, in or destroying the Eiffel Tower. You know, like what a easy layup of 10 seconds of footage is maybe some people running away from the base, some tourists, and the Eiffel Tower going down, or I forget where else they were showing things were happening, but there's just, if you're going to do a world kaiju destruction, it's like, show us the world getting destroyed. And that's
more like, I mean, it's something that's been done so much the 10 years prior, where like they would do little like webisodes of stuff. Like if they had filmed like, you know, little bits and pieces of like, hey, do you want to see the Behemoth's like rampage or like awakening and stuff? And they talk about like, one even popped up in Wisconsin. Yeah, or Montana. Show us that. Like, show a kaiju popping up in the middle of nowhere, you know, America. Like, I would love to see that.
So that I can't ding them points for that, because
no. This is purely just me. Like, if this was like a $500 million, like six episode hour long, you know, show or something, which we might get soon.
I will ding them points for some reason. And I feel like this is cutting room floor as well. Ghidorah destroys the U.S. Capitol. Ghidorah destroys Washington, D.C. And we don't get to see it. We get to see the after effects, and it's flooded. Like, DC is flooded to the point where like battleships can like go past like the Capitol building and stuff like that. We get to see that attack, but we don't get to see the destruction happen. And it's like, man, there's so many things you can do there, and we didn't get to see any of them. We didn't get to see Abe Lincoln getting crushed. We didn't get to see Ghidorah just like picking up the Washington Monument and chucking it for no reason.
Well, I mean, you only get so much time, and they already made this movie 2 hours and 12 minutes. So, I mean,
that's the thing.
I
wanted so much more, and there's so many things that kind of get like, they don't introduce the USS Argo at all in the film. They're just all of a sudden on this giant airship that is like a pretty key part of the movie.
I think for me, like, again, this kind of feels more Showa-ish. Like, I don't mind like moving things along for the sake of like moving the story along so we can get to more monster stuff. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like, I also like some of the destruction being kind of contextual. Like, I kind of like showing up at DC or seeing a shot at DC and it's just wasted. So for me, sometimes that's more effectful than actually seeing it get destroyed. It's just like, wow. It's a double-edged sword, but we get so much like destruction from the monsters that like, It's kind of hard to ding it, because like, oh, well, I didn't get to see this place get destroyed.
We really don't until Boston, you know, because there's like a fight.
Oh, I don't know about that. I mean, when
there's a fight in the snow, there's a fight over the ocean,
and there's a fight in Mexico.
I will say it. Isla Del Mara is one of my favorite parts because of the callbacks to the original Rodan, like Rodan basically making a tsunami force winds and like sucking people off the street. That was great.
Yeah,
I could have done with a full 10 more minutes of its destruction or
the, I mean, at the same time, I'm Rodan like, you know, fight. I could do a Rodan movie. That'd be fine. Like, I wouldn't mind. I mean, I know we have Monarch, which does go into some of these other titans a little bit. But like, I still would love like more stuff outside of the Godzilla films about these titans. I don't know if there's enough for. I mean, I think what Happy Parson Light Monarch. I don't know if there is the audience for a Godzilla less of these movies. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. But something Light Monarch would probably work. But yeah, I love the kind of the overall like sequence of actions. I like how they got the right actor as far as the kind of hurt protagonist for Kyle Chandler, because he has so much of that like good old American apple pie look to him. And I mean, because for most Americans, they see him as, you know, Friday Night Lights, you know, clear eyes, full hearts, can't lose. And
I will say he is like the heart and soul of this movie, because he actually has, which is so rare in a kaiju film, character development. He starts off absolutely hating Godzilla, and at the end he is like rooting for the big G, and we find out very early on it's because his family lived in San Francisco. His son was killed during the 2014 attack, and it kind of broke up the family in different ways. But yeah, what his transformation, I think, happened when Serizawa revitalized Godzilla and Mothra came, and he realized that they were pretty much, if not a force for good, very much a neutral force that was there to help stop Ghidorah from destroying the planet. And
right.
It's good. It's very good storytelling. A lot of good visual storytelling in that part, because he's never like, okay, I like Godzilla now. He doesn't say that in the script, which is good, but you can see.
No, but like you can see the understanding. The development does happen. I love all the fights. Like we get, you know, your opening salvo of Godzilla and Ghidorah up in the Antarctica. Is that where it is?
Is it the South Pole or the?
I can't remember which pole it is, but it's one of the poles, right?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's Antarctica.
Okay, so you get that, which is, you know, Ghidorah, it gets kind of a W there, but mostly because Godzilla loses his balance and gets dropped into the water. And then you have the fight in Mexico over the water, which is kind of, you know, no one really wins that one because of the Oxygen Destroyer that takes Godzilla kind of out of the fight a little bit. Mm-hmm. Although Godzilla wasn't exactly in prime condition, but this is where we get the idea that, like, okay, well, why didn't the Oxygen Destroyer do anything to King Ghidorah? It should have done anything that's natural to this planet. And that's where the revelation is. Well, there is some belief that he's not from this planet. And I love that, because it gives us this really cool way of him being an alien without doing a whole alien subplot, which I thought was really, really cool. And then we get the kind of recharging him and getting him into Boston, where we get to see Boston get absolutely wrecked.
Well, completely leveled, I would say, for sure. And yeah, it starts with
and a fight in Fenway Park, which is pretty awesome.
Well, and it's kind of funny, Ghidorah is the one to destroy the green monster, which is like, okay, that's fine. But yeah, Fenway's getting destroyed first. It would have been funny if Godzilla had came in and just stepped on the giant wall. But
yeah, but who is Ghidorah's enemy?
The big G.
The big green monster.
I feel like it turned into a very generic kind of like cityscape in the course of the battle, because there's like multiple buildings that seem like they fall several times in the course of the fight. But so, that was kind of something that I feel like happened a little bit in San Francisco in that fight.
Yeah, I mean, that's going to happen in any of these movies, and I'm fine with that. I had to listen to you and the Nemesis author kind of complain about, oh, well, they didn't do this, this, and this about Boston, and this about Boston.
Jeremy Robinson did it originally in his books, of course.
And I was just like, listen, I hate to break it to both of you.
Nobody cares about Boston.
No, yes. The one thing that most Americans can pick out as a landmark in Boston is Fenway Park and maybe the harbor where they threw some tea. Like everything else. And look, I love Boston. It's a very historical town. It's very, very cool. But if you're talking about the most like ubiquitous things about that city, Fenway Park is number one. And it gets front and center and gets completely wrecked. I mean, that's like destroying the Statue of Liberty or like the Empire State Building. Like that is the defining thing. And it's the one thing that most people are going to care about concerning Boston.
There was actual filming locations in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico, but the vast majority of this film was filmed in good old Atlanta, Georgia. Black Hall Studios, all of the Antarctica set was, and I'm pretty sure Boston too, was Atlanta filling in. And I think it is funny, Kyle Chandler looks like he is absolutely sweating his butt off in Antarctica because, you know, all the actors are wearing these heavy coats and stuff, and they're just in some, it's probably like 90 degrees outside when they're shooting this movie. But I thought the human sets, especially in this film, were great. I will say, and rightly so, there's a lot of criticism about this movie, and it helps, I think, move kaiju films forward after this, is a lot of criticism about the kaiju fights being hidden by darkness or hidden by weather. About every single time the kaiju fight, there is a storm going on, and they kind of give an in-universe reason in that King Ghidorah can basically create hurricanes or control hurricanes, move storms around with them. So I
also hear about this complaint a lot. I remember James Rolfe had brought it up when he did Monster Jam or something, whatever he does during October. Monster Madness. Yes, it's not Monster Vision because that was the Joe Bob Briggs show. And I've heard this complaint a lot, and I just don't get it. Because these films are well made enough that you can see the monsters clearly. Like I don't understand. And look, I mean, obviously, in the next two films, you see them lit up in the daytime. You see them in neon lights and all that stuff. So that's all well and good. But like, I just do not care about that argument. I think it's dumb. Like,
well, I will say, I feel like
I don't see it as a complaint in that, like, oh, this is bad because they're all in the dark. And I'm like, you can see them clearly, especially in Boston. Mm-hmm. Like,
I feel like the previous movie, Godzilla is almost only shown at night, and that's like for the most part done fairly well. Here, I think having most of the fights at night and the storm effects are just a bit much, because like there's just one of them easily could have done just during the day and in the snowstorm, maybe like Antarctica or something. But I will say, I think one of my favorite fights is Ghidorah versus Rodan, or just Rodan's kind of introduction as well, and that is during the day. So they do have some variety, I would say, in where and how these fights are happening. But yeah, that one's just so interesting. It's a completely aerial kaiju combat, which, you know, in the Gamera movies that can happen, but just doesn't happen in Godzilla a lot, obviously, because Godzilla does not typically fly. He's been known to shoot backwards and scoot along.
Yeah, he does do that sometimes.
Oh, he flies in this movie. He like goes into outer space and burst on fire.
Oh, that's right.
With reentry, which is a ridiculous part of the movie, but I'm here for it at that point.
I love it.
You're along for the ride. Yeah, but I think we could talk a little bit about reactions to this film.
Everyone's wrong except mine.
It is bonkers. The Rotten Tomatoes, there are 352 at the time of recording this reviews from critics. And it has a splatty tomato, Miles. It is 42% rotten.
Fools. All of them.
What movie were they watching? I'm so confused by this.
I don't know. I have no idea.
the kind of, I don't know if this is written by someone or AI generator or what these days, but the critics consensus says Godzilla King of the Monsters delivers spectacular kaiju action and reaffirms that cutting edge effects are still no substitute for a good story. I thought the story was fine. It's actually a pretty darn good human story, and like they have to help Godzilla beat Ghidorah. Yeah. Like they do several things to really have an effect on these monster fights. The audience score is, I think, much more forgiving, even though it's still a bit low for what I would figure people wanting to go see a kaiju movie would rate this. It's 83% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Still plenty of fools in this world, Patrick.
I remember being so hyped for this film. And I think some of those initial reviews came out, and it wasn't as low when the movie came out as like 60 or 70%. But yeah, critics just decided to pile up on this. And it's crazy because, what, a few years before this, even something like Pacific Rim got a 72% audience rating, which I understand. You know, they're not the same movie, but they're not that crazy different, like story-wise, as far as like quality of the human story goes. I think they both have very similar kind of flaws and rough spots, but there's a 30% kind of critical difference between them. Yeah, I think you're right in the fools criticism. Do you have a favorite scene or element of this movie that makes it, you know, either very rewatchable or just like a fun thing you want to point out?
There are so many. I mean, I cannot stress how many times I've rewatched this movie. And it does help because
four times in theaters, boy, howdy.
There's that. But also, once upon a time, and as Patrick knows and is now part of the herd, I spend many hours a week watching All Elite Wrestling. Wrestling used to be on TNT. And TNT airs a movie like at 6 o'clock every Wednesday, so that it ends around 8. And for whatever reason, because obviously they would use a lot of like Warner Brothers properties, a lot of times I would watch the last like 15 minutes of this movie before wrestling came on. Not that I didn't already own the movie and seen it many times anyway. But one of my favorite moments is it's after Millie Bobby Brown's character as Madison has tricked everyone to all the creatures to come to Fenway Park as opposed to like a good baseball team like the Atlanta Braves.
Lewis Park. What was her plan there?
I don't remember. Her plan is basically to detract Peter long enough so that Godzilla can get there. I think is what it is.
I guess she doesn't know that Godzilla was like destroyed. There's so many like weird plot things like that. It's like,
yeah, and I mean she doesn't, but also like I think the idea is to like if Ghidorah can be at least be distracted from his end goal just a little bit, she can buy everyone else some time. I think that I know they flat out state exactly what she plans to do.
Yeah, and the other kaiju kind of she's attracting all the kaiju, not just Ghidorah.
Right. I think she's hoping that by utilizing the orca, she can shake the hold of some of them, or possibly, you know, just hold them off for a little bit. But anyway, Ghidorah is having none of it. And there's the sequence where he is about to decimate Madison. And she's, you know, does the whole screaming in anguish and anger and at him in defiance. And then all of a sudden, you know, kind of the heads rear back to attack, and then they're distracted briefly. And then you get the needle drop of the original theme, and boy, oh boy, whose house? And
it's not just Godzilla coming, but like 20, I'm guessing just Monarch, like Monarch has an Air Force. They have like tons of jets, and obviously the Argo is there.
Unfortunately, Wayne from Letterkenny is not a part of this
team. Oh my gosh. In my heart, he is. He's still there.
But you know who is? Apparently, I think it is in this one of these sequences, Seth Green.
Oh, weird.
And it's just, I think it's a voice cameo of like him and Eli Roth. But I love that sequence of, I'm always a big fan of the Godzilla coming back to save the day. It was one of my favorites in the original, like Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla in 1974, where you see the bubbles pop up and he pops out after you think he's been killed. Mm-hmm. I'm always a big fan of that comeback. We've seen him get regenerated and rejuvenated and everything. And just having that comeback, and then I did it myself, but like I really wanted to take the music cue and just have that like Swerve Strickland like Whose House playing, and because he comes in and just like railroads Ghidorah. That's one of my favorite sequences in the movie. Obviously, Godzilla slurping down one of them heads like it's ramen noodles is fantastic.
Yeah, they knew they had to do something different from the excellent atomic breath down the throat of the Muto in the first film, and they have a pretty cool element with Ghidorah. You think Ghidorah has survived this crazy blast, this final blast, because the head seems to be still alive or moving on its own. But yeah, it's just Godzilla finishing off the last of them. But
what about you? Did you have a favorite part?
It makes me think. Yeah. Ghidorah's heads have to be like eaten in order for it not to regenerate, which
also you gotta love how he has that little electricity burp after he eats that head.
Yes. I think it's the same thing. The climax of the movie is so cathartic after, you know, Godzilla's beaten. Godzilla's nearly destroyed in this film. You know, it's something you rarely see.
Not by Ghidorah though.
Well, no,
it's the Oxygen Destroyer.
No, Godzilla is losing battles against Ghidorah in this movie.
He's not doing great, but there's still time. There's still time.
And yeah, he needs to be supercharged. And we basically get a legendary version of Heisei's burning Godzilla in this movie, which is awesome to see just Godzilla walking through Boston and all the buildings melting around him. Just so cool. I will say, yeah, when that original soundtrack came in, and we get snippets, I think, of the Japanese kind of like Imperial March as well. Both of those used at the right times is, I think it should be required for a Godzilla movie. You know, like if you can get the rights and make it happen, you need to, directors. Mm-hmm. Godzilla is just so inexorably tied to that music. And it's the same thing. Spoiler warnings for Godzilla Minus One. When that music comes in to that movie, it's like, oh, thank you. Put this in an IV and just stick it straight in my arm. But yeah. Besides that, I think I already mentioned the Rodan's introduction is one of my favorite parts of this movie. I feel like it is fleshed out. It is, you know, it is filmed on location in Mexico. It looks great. Production value super high. It is during the day. And it adds a little bit to Rodan. You know, I think we've gotten it, Rodan as kind of like an elemental guardian kind of figure before, but it being like a volcano, active volcano monster and like molten in different parts of the movie is just really cool. And I also like how he's kind of a stooge. He comes under Ghidorah's spell. And then at the end, he's like, okay, now Godzilla is the big, he bows down to Godzilla.
Watching them all bow to Godzilla at the end is, I mean, I don't know. That might be my favorite scene, actually.
So good. But yeah,
because Godzilla is also like, yeah, of course you do. there was no other answer.
In general, the reverence for the show in Heisei Aries is what, on rewatching, I can appreciate the most. Like, I want to pause whenever they're showing all the different Monarch bases, which, thanks to Wikizilla and IMDb, people have gone through and sussed out all the references. Outpost 56, I believe, is Rodan's Isla del Mara one, and that is a reference to its film debut in 1956. 61, Outpost 61 is a reference to Mothra's film debut. 54, Godzilla's, yada yada. 32 and 31, I think, are the Antarctic base, which is a reference to The Thing, which is kind of interesting. There's just so many of them. Skull Island's Outpost 33, which is, of course, King Kong's original film. There's a whole bunch of those, and it just shows like an attention to detail from the production team that I really appreciate as someone that loves these films. And yeah, this movie, I mean, if anything, I made mention of it being the Avengers of the Godzilla films. This is only the third MonsterVerse film, though. And it feels like, oh no, we're not going to have all these toys to play with for too much longer. Let's do this movie while we can, you know?
Yeah, that was the feeling, was like, you know, the initial idea was that we were getting a trilogy. Like, we were doing Godzilla, King of the Monsters, and versus Kong, and that would be the end of it. Which is wild, because when you watch versus Kong, you never feel like it's the end of it.
No, to be honest, it feels like versus Kong should have come kind of before this movie, and then Kong could have been a part of this crazy worldwide battle, you know? This feels like the closing of a arc of films, as opposed to the penultimate film. But it is weird to also have the movie prior to this be Kong Skull Island, and then Kong doesn't factor into this at all, you know? But that doesn't take away from this film. This being Godzilla 2 is a film that can stand by itself. Let's get to rating this. I feel like we could do a full two episodes about Godzilla King of the Monsters. Maybe we should do a watch through at some point. We can talk about this movie even more. That would constitute like three or four full hours about talking about this film. But I guess I think we could flush it out. I love this movie. I think it is one that can actually get better on rewatch. And that is a mark of a 10 out of 10 film for me. I can rewatch this pretty much whenever, and it's hard. I don't think this is the best of the MonsterVerse, but obviously at the time this was the best, or this is not the one that I enjoyed the most. This might be the best, but this movie is an absolute riot no matter what. Seeing this in theaters, I think if you close down theaters, you're losing something pretty major, and it's for films like this to flourish. The genre is so amazing that it makes me happy every time I see this movie. And I'm hoping this will just continue to hold up. You know, obviously we're only like 7 years since it came out, but I hope there's a time that, or I hope there's not a time that another movie will make this look bad by comparison, you know, but who knows? Miles, I'm guessing from the way you've talked about this film, this episode, that you enjoyed this. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I love this movie. It's legitimately one of my favorites. And it's, in terms of just like pure fun, like, I mean, because we've talked about the many like kinds of Godzilla films there are. Mm-hmm. And in terms of like just like the pure fun ones, this is up there with me, some of the absolute best. I think I mentioned how much I love this movie when we first talked about this podcast, like in our first episodes where we talked about some of our favorites. And I remember mm-hmm. saying, like, you know, yeah, some people don't agree with me, but Godzilla King of the Monsters is absolutely up there. So yeah, 10 out of 10 every single time. My excitement for this movie has not waned one iota since the first, second, third, or fourth time I watched this movie in theaters.
Yeah, and I think it's so good. Like, I'm looking for that same high in the Godzilla versus and Godzilla X Kong movies. And I think the last one maybe got there, but like, it's hard to top this movie as far as enjoyment goes.
I'm with you. The last one does get close. I just don't get super excited about another monkey antagonist.
Oh, it's a lot of Kong in that film. That's the other thing. I just want
I feel like the reasons because of that is like they weren't certain how much Godzilla they were going to be able to use.
Yeah,
and
now they Toho whatever they want.
Yeah, now that's a little bit more like, yeah, we should absolutely have more Godzilla, and yeah. But how do you feel about the technical aspect?
So this is a place where I do think this movie deserves a little ding is its technical score, because I feel like the script either went through a great deal of revisions, or there's some bits that were left in the editing bay. Or, yeah, like I said, lost in translation between some of the rewrites that have happened and happened in the course of any movie. But having so many characters and so much plot in a 2 hour and 12 minute runtime, it does seem criminal. I feel like this movie could have easily been pushing 3 hours and I would not have complained. It already moves at such a fast clip that I don't think adding in a little bit more exposition, a little bit more action, you know, in some parts would have really hurt it. 2014 just took its time so much in that movie, and I feel like this one is, they're just kind of rushing to get to all these cool toy chest kind of moments of monsters fighting. And yeah, it, I want the director's cut is what I'm saying. I feel like this movie, if you add, God, just 10 or 15 more minutes, it could have solved some of the very minor errors. But I didn't give the original 1954 Godzilla movie a perfect 10 out of 10 score for some of its technical errors. And I feel like I can't give this one the same score. That being said, like, yeah, there's just some writing story elements that I'm still confused by on rewatch. Like, what does Madison know about her mom? It seems like they are both in on it at one point, but
Charles Dance does say, what exactly did you tell her? Like, so she's been given a version of events.
Yes.
But I don't think, and even Vera Farmiga is like, you know, also thinks things are gonna be a little bit different, but also no one knew what Monster Zero really was.
Yeah. Well, it's is like one of the core plots of the film is like this family dynamic and like her running away. And it's like, I don't quite understand like why or like what it was beforehand, because they do that kind of pull one over on the audience. It's like, oh no, she's in on it like halfway through the movie, where it makes it seem every scene before then they're very much being coerced, like they're being led by at gunpoint, you know. It just seems like they're trying a bit too hard in that plot. Anyway, I'm giving this a 9 out of 10. It is very close because of how good the music and some of the treatment of the monsters are to be in a 10 out of 10, but not perfect for me, Miles. What about you?
Incorrect. 10 out of 10. No, I love the cast of this movie. I love the score of this movie. I think the movie looks great. I think all of the monsters get at least some time to shine in some capacity. The fact that they have an ensemble of monsters, an ensemble of human characters, an ensemble of ideas, and make it all work within a 2-hour time frame. Like, yeah, is there stuff they had to cut away a little bit? Sure. But mm-hmm. And would I have loved like the 4-hour version of this idea? Absolutely. But with what I got, I don't have a single real issue with this film. Actually, no, you know what? I do have a little thing I took a note of. I just wrote, how come no one is getting shit in their eyes with all this strong wind in the disastrous Boston? like there is like hurricane force winds and like a decimated city. We see all this dust, all this debris, all this stuff flying around, and no one's got glasses on. Mm-hmm. And they are fine. But I am not going to ding that at all. It is what it is. It's a fantasy film. Whatever. 10 out of 10.
Well, what about its importance as a piece of kaiju art, Miles?
So this, as we've talked about, is kind of the peak of the golden age of kaiju cinema. This gives what all the monster fans had wanted. That we get $200 million movie with some of the most famous monsters of all time. I don't know. I think no matter how well this movie did, no matter how many people like it or don't like it, I think the trajectory of kaiju cinema as we know it changed when this movie was released. Just the fact that this movie came out, I think, signaled, oh, we are in a different era than we've been before. Because not only, and this isn't the highest grossing, it's actually, I think, one of the lowest grossing of the MonsterVerse, because this is such a successful franchise, but it still did very well. But because this movie came out, this Western version of these wonderful Japanese characters came out, was still a big hit, got another movie made. I mean, it did the MonsterVerse has done everything they expected 98's film to do. And that is the big difference. And I don't think without this movie, you quite have the tsunami of kaiju films and influenced films making it here, celebrated here. I don't think without this movie you have Minus One in 2024. Mm-hmm. The plan was to have a trilogy and then for Godzilla to go back to Toho for a Japanese cinematic universe. Minus One was kind of planned possibly as a one-off idea, and it took the world by storm. But I don't think any of that happens without this. It's certainly informed by kaiju, like the kaiju films that came before it. And it honors that history. It does new things and introduces new monsters and shows that there is so much more that we can do with these characters, with these monsters, with the idea that these monsters represent. And I don't think that happens without this one. So 15 out of 10.
I'm writing down 10 out of 10.
That is a 15.
I think I agree with you there. I think this movie almost sets too high a bar for kaiju movies, because like I said, it does feel like it swung for the fences. And it's like, well, what if we can never make another movie with Rodan and Mothra again? Let's do something crazy. And I think time has proven the kaiju fandom does enjoy this film, and it sets the tone certainly for the rest of the more unrealistic films in the MonsterVerse, the more kind of colorful.
Like, if you had told me that they were to really go all in on that Hollow Earth idea, I would have been like, what?
Yeah, well, it's something that was mentioned in Kong, and then they brought it up again. Technically, they think they went through a tunnel, like the submarine in this film, to get to the ancient underwater temple. Yeah, his napping spot. And to be honest, you know, we A-bombed that area, so he has first dibs on the Colosseum in Rome in the next couple movies. But yeah, it is a Showa era film. It's got some Heisei kind of drama elements to it, and it has the big budget of Hollywood behind it. But you know, in researching this, Miles, it is bananas. This movie didn't crack the top 20 highest grossing films of 2019. We were so lucky before the pandemic in as far as films.
Oh yeah, because I mean, movies were making so much money then. Like, they were still made decent money,
but making bank. Well, you know what beat it? Godzilla King of the Monsters was number 22 highest grossing film. Alita Battle Angel was number 21.
Which we're still apparently supposed to be a sequel for, which I look, that movie rules. So I'm fine with that.
It's good. But yeah, number one, obviously, Avengers Endgame is like one of the highest grossing movies of all time. We had Disney dominating the top five films with Lion King, Frozen 2, Spider-Man Far From Home, I guess technically with Sony. Captain Marvel was Disney up there. Captain Marvel made $1 billion. The Joker movie made $1 billion. There's a Star Wars movie. There's just so many things coming out. I can see why this movie didn't do as well as I think it should have or could have. It had so much competition. And critically, I mean, boy howdy, I don't understand where the critics were coming from. Critically, I feel like this movie, like I said, has just done so much better in time since it's come out. And yeah, if the MonsterVerse had ended, if we didn't get Godzilla versus Kong, I would have been totally happy with this. You know, they, like I said, swung for the fences. They didn't make $1 billion, but they did well. And I enjoyed my theatrical experience. And like you said, this does set up for future movies and hopefully a long continuing MonsterVerse. I would like them to branch out and try new things. It is fine if every other movie is just Godzilla and Kong fighting and then making up and becoming friends. I'm cool with that, but I'm giving this a 10 out of 10 as well for its importance. Obviously.
Yes.
Which puts us both at 10 out of 10 rounded up for this movie and our podcast final, a 10 out of 10. We've had a lot of 10 out of 10 Godzilla movies. I think this is number five or six.
Probably.
We previously have given Godzilla Final Wars a 10 out of 10, Godzilla versus Destoroyah, Godzilla versus Biollante, and Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla, as well as the original Gojira. So I guess this is number six. How many did I just say?
One, two. Oh gosh.
Yeah, this is number six as far as Godzilla movies goes, which is pretty crazy. You know, you think maybe there'd be a few more in its history, but I'm pretty happy. Like I said, as soon as I get done talking about this movie, I feel like I can immediately go back and watch this another time. And that is really the true mark of the 10 out of 10s. I can watch those almost any time.
Oh yeah.
I have to be in a mood or whatever.
This might be the kaiju movie I've seen the most times in general.
Yeah, yeah, you mentioned that, and I can, I think maybe me as well. I don't know. It's hard to say. I feel like I've seen some of the Gamera movies a whole bunch, but yeah, this one, it's also, like you said, it's just in the perfect climb that it is so accessible outside of being out on DVD and what have you. You saw it a ton on TV. It's on multiple streaming services, getting ping ponged around, getting watched. And yeah, like I said, if you're listening out there and you put together theatrical packages for the new movies coming out, re-release this one in theaters. I will go see it again easily in theaters. Miles, are you going to see it a fifth time in theaters if they put it out for an anniversary? Or
absolutely.
Something? Okay. All right, so that's going to do it for us. Where can folks find us, Miles, if they want to talk about kaiju, things kaiju?
Well, you can email us at kaijuversushistory.com or at gmail.com. You can go to our website, kaijuversushistory.com. You can talk to us on Blue Sky, Kaiju vs. History. You can rate, review our show, share, comment with your friends. Check out our Letterboxd account, Kaiju vs. History, to see all our reviews and watch our list of films. You can also go to our sister show's website, Cosmic Crit, and join our Discord. There is a Kaiju vs. History channel there where you can talk to Patrick and myself and anyone there about whatever your favorite kaiju movie is, your kaiju scene is, your favorite kaiju, or share some kaiju news, toys, whatever, in real time, any day of the week. Patrick, what are we doing next week? We're flying high right now. We got some good stuff next, right? It's gotta be good, right?
Rut-row, Raggy. Thank you, Miles. Thank you, listeners. We're gonna catch you next time when the shoe is on the other foot and we head from, as you said, flying high with Godzilla, King of the Monsters. One of the most expensive kaiju movies ever made, by the way. I don't think we mentioned that, but $200 million, that is a lot of money. We head from Hollywood to a film that might hold the record for the least amount of money spent on a kaiju movie. So tune in next time when we explore the depths of indie homemade monster films and we watch History versus Zillafoot.